Okay, they told me that he was in front of them.
State Government Finance Committee will come to order. Thank you very much. I had to get my committee fixed for the week, so.
How you doing?
We spent evenings and nights together, so what's it like first thing in the morning? I thought I should find that out before the interim starts. And today we have House File 863 before us, but Representative Winkler and Simon are trying to get through the tunnel. And so they are held up. But Mr. Goldsmith has consented to give us the walkthrough on the bill. Two amendments were submitted as requested by the time period that Ms. Conley set out, and that is 863A10 and A63A8. But I think I would rather have Mr. Simon, Representative Simon Winkler, both here before we take up the amendments. But we do have a great interest in the bill itself, Mr. Goldsmith. So if you would be so kind.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I appreciate the opportunity to be here before you this morning, and hope that Representative Winkler's confidence in me is well placed. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board, and actually this bill incorporates the board's legislative recommendations for 2013, and actually it doesn't have any provision in it that is not a board recommendation, and the provisions that are in it have been somewhat modified since the bill was introduced, but always at the board's urging to accommodate the needs of some of the interest groups that were affected by the bill. Much of the bill is non-controversial. Some of it is technical, and some of it is not technical but policy-oriented, and there is some controversy in a couple of the provisions, which I'll certainly talk about. There's a small fiscal note on the bill. However, in both the Senate and the House budget, the board is being given an increase in its base funding, which the board had requested. And that increase would cover the fiscal note. So this fiscal note would not be in addition to the money that's already in the budget bills for the board. The bill, I will sort of walk through following the overview that Mr. Gehring has prepared for you. The bill first in section 1 and 2 defines ballot question, political committee, and fund. The purpose of doing this is so that ballot question committees and funds can have separate requirements compared to other types of committees and funds. For example, another provision of the bill increases the threshold for registration of those types of committees to $5,000, because based on the current legal thinking, ballot question groups should not have to register and report until they reach a higher threshold. So in order to have a separate threshold, we have to have a separate definition. section 3 is a technical change correcting an internal reference. Section 4 slightly modifies the definition of contribution, but not in any way that will change the way Chapter 10A has been administered. We've always treated a transfer from an association to its political fund the same as a contribution for disclosure purposes. This simply makes it clear that that's what we should be doing, and the board's been doing that for the 35 years it's been in existence. Section 5 is the first section that is to some extent controversial, and there is at least one group that has some concern about this section. The phrase expressly advocating is used only one place in Chapter 10A, and that's in the definition of independent expenditure. An independent expenditure is an expenditure expressly advocating the election or defeat of a clearly identified candidate. However, that phrase expressly advocating is not defined in Chapter 10A, and up to this point, the board has not undertaken to define that through the administrative rulemaking process. Rather, the board recommends that the legislature undertake that definition. I distributed to most of you a letter, and I've met with some of you to talk about this particular issue. Minnesota's law came into effect just after the Buckley versus Vallejo case in the early 70s, when the court said that express advocacy probably required the use of words like vote for, vote against, and so on, the so-called magic words. The law changed after that based on Supreme Court holdings, and the court subsequently concluded you don't need those magic words before you can require disclosure of speech related to elections. If the speech is subject to no other interpretation at all, no other reasonable interpretation than as advocacy, you can still require disclosure. And so what Section 5 does is it codifies the definition of express advocacy using both forms, the original Buckley versus Vallejo form, which is the magic words form of express advocacy, and then it incorporates Chief Justice Roberts' language from the Wisconsin Right to Life case that says express advocacy also includes speech that is subject to no other reasonable interpretation. And the language of the amendment incorporates almost word for word Justice Roberts' language and also the concepts that he enunciated when talking about when you should find that express advocacy results as under this particular definition. And this definition, by the way, was subsequently upheld, including most recently in Citizens United. So the Supreme Court, at least, does not have a concern about its vagueness or susceptibility to interpretation. Section 6 is a rather technical definition. It defines general treasury money, which is money that typically a nonprofit would get that's just money that's given to them, not for any particular purpose. And that money is treated differently for disclosure purposes than money that is raised specifically to promote or defeat a ballot question or to elect a candidate. And so we define that so that we can put different disclosure provisions on that type of money, which are less stringent than the disclosure that would be required of money that's specifically raised to influence elections. Section 7 is a technical definition. The word person is used many places in the statute. We've reviewed the whole statute, and in almost every place, it means both an individual or an association or any other kind of entity. So person now will be clearly meant to identify virtually anybody or anything, as opposed to individual, which means just a human being. Section 8 is a technical change. Political committee has always been interpreted to mean money that is used to influence one or more than one candidate. Most political committees influence many candidates or several candidates. And a political fund, Section 9, again, a technical definition. A political fund actually isn't an entity. It isn't something. It's a pool of money. However, in the statute and in our common vernacular, we often talk about a political fund as if it was an entity. And so this, the last sentence in Section 9, which is on page 3, line 27, simply says that when we say political fund, we don't mean some separate entity from the association. We're just talking about this pool of money. Section 10 is one of several sections which include 11 and 12, which somewhat expand the board's jurisdiction. And these provisions were included in the 2010 legislation, which stalled for other reasons, but were not opposed by anybody, to my knowledge, at that time. They would add three provisions that are in Chapter 211B to the board's jurisdiction only with respect to those candidates and committees that are already under the board's jurisdiction through Chapter 10A. And those provisions are, first of all, the provision that requires a disclaimer that says prepared and paid for by. The board already has the disclaimer provision relating to independent expenditures. Another provision would be the use of legal uses of campaign money. The board has the provision that governs legal use of money for non-campaign disbursements, but not the provision that governs legal use of money for campaign purposes. And the third provision would be the application of the corporate contribution prohibition to the extent that it still exists, which is it still does exist for direct contributions, though not independent expenditures. The reason the board asked in 2010 and asks again for jurisdiction over these provisions, there are actually a couple of reasons. First of all, these are important provisions that govern how candidate campaigns, political committees, and parties operate. Chapter 211B does not have any kind of agency like the board that has jurisdiction over it for the purpose of answering questions, interpreting it, issuing advisory opinions. Your only option when you have a problem with 211B is to file a complaint or respond to a complaint that was filed with the Office of Administrative Hearings, or if you're really lucky, you might find an opinion from that body that already exists that might shed some light on your subject. However, the OAH doesn't issue advisory opinions, do administrative rulemaking, or even answer questions. So we get those questions, and the problem is we try to answer them. We point people to the right statute. We tell them how Chapter 10A would work in that situation. And then we say, but whatever I tell you, and I get the questions mostly, whatever I tell you is not authoritative, and you need to seek your own legal advice. So we believe that's a disservice to the committees that are required to comply with those provisions. And because we're already trying to answer the questions to the extent that we can, it would be more beneficial to the regulated communities if we had the legal authority to do that. Secondly, these are three provisions that relate very closely either to finance or to provisions the board already administers, like the independent expenditure disclaimer provision. So they're not something that's new to us. We have no interest in taking over Chapter 211B. Much of it relates to access to buildings, placement of signs, false campaign advertising. Those are things that the board does not have expertise in and would not be interested in taking over. But these three things are financially related and important. And so the provisions that I mentioned, sections 10, 11, and 12, add those to our investigative authority, to our advisory opinion-making authority, and to our violations enforcement. There's another provision in section 12, beginning at line 5.1 on page 5, and this is a new authority for the board, and this has gone, of course, through the Judiciary Committee. This bill has been through several committees already. Occasionally, and by that I mean once or twice a year, we find a committee that apparently has disposed of its money in a way that either it cannot account for or that appears to be improper under Chapter 211B. Typically, it will be a candidate whose committee has terminated. They're not going to be active anymore, and they've used the money for what appears to be personal purposes. Other times, we've actually found cases of embezzlement. And, of course, we want the owner of that money to take action to get it back, but in some cases, that doesn't or can't happen. And this provision, after a lot of notice and opportunity by the committee whose money it was to take action, if they decide they don't want to, ultimately the board would be permitted, though not required, to take action to recover that money. But if it did so, the board would get back only its cost of filing fees, cost of depositions, and service of process. The Attorney General's office would recover its costs of prosecuting the matter, and then the balance would go back to the rightful owner of that money originally, unless it was a candidate who took the money of his or her own committee, in which case the money would go to the public subsidy program. Now, I haven't had anybody complain about this, but it seemed to my board that when we see these cases and we realize that no one is doing anything about them, even though they're few and far between, there ought to be at least the threat that some agency is going to come after you to get that money back if you've misused it. Moving on to page 6, line 14, this provision is a corollary to a provision that's in Chapter 211B. It just says that because certain provisions, both under 211B and 10A, are subject to criminal prosecution. This provision, like the one in 211B, would prohibit a city or county attorney from bringing that prosecution until the board has completed its investigation. So it provides a level of protection for committees that county attorneys or city attorneys can't be out there simply starting to prosecute without having gone through a board process first. I might add that that Representative Winkler's technical amendment will insert city or before county attorney, because the misdemeanors in metro areas are prosecuted by the city attorney. Section 13 adds those new provisions of 211B to the advisory opinion authority that the board already has. Section 14 relates to the requirement that a person signing a report certify it to be true. And that's been in existence for a long, long time. The problem that we encountered a year ago is that in some cases someone else will prepare the report and put it in front of the treasurer to sign. The person who prepared the report may know that it's incomplete. In fact, in one investigation, did know that it was incomplete, put it in front of the treasurer who signed it, and a complaint was filed, which we investigated. The treasurer didn't know that the report was incorrect, so there was no violation on the part of the treasurer, but there was no recourse against the person who prepared the report knowing it was incorrect. And so this provision would add a clause that says the individual who knowingly provides to the treasurer a false report with the intent that the treasurer rely on it is also going to be subject to civil penalties and possible prosecution as a gross misdemeanor, which is the current language of the statute for the treasurer. Section 15 is similar. Only the treasurer has record-keeping responsibility under the statute, and this would add a record-keeping responsibility to a person who was delegated by and accepted that delegation of responsibility for record-keeping. So this would be like a finance director of a state party unit or some similar position that is formally charged with keeping records. Also, there's no penalty for failing to keep records, none at all, other than a criminal penalty, which never gets imposed. And so this provision would add a civil penalty for the failure to keep records. I might note that on line 8.6, a knowing violation, the line says, is a gross misdemeanor. That's a continuation of existing language, except Representative Winkler's amendment will strike the word gross. That was an error. Under the existing statute, it's a misdemeanor, and the board did not intend to change that. The next several sections increase registration thresholds. Registration thresholds have not been increased for a long, long time. I think there were some adjustments early on, but not in the last 20 years or so. And so for a regular campaign committee, the person would no longer have to register until they've raised $750 instead of just $100. This is consistent with what's already done at the local level. They don't have to register or actually file a report until they've raised $750. This will permit, for example, somebody to seek the endorsement at a convention and spend a little bit of money and not have to register with the board when they do that. Section 17 it relates to, and I need a moment to review this to make sure I get it right. This relates to a regular political committee and fund, one that can make contributions to candidates and party units. They also are raised to $750. Section 18 raises independent expenditure committee filing thresholds to $1,500 and ballot question thresholds to $5,000. The reason for the high amount for ballot questions is the general consensus of the court, although there's no Supreme Court opinion, but the general consensus is that when you're talking about a ballot question, the state's interest in seeing who's influencing that is less than with a candidate committee, for example, because once the question is over, there's no candidate left to influence. So if you spend $5,000 on a ballot question, there's nobody going to be left out there that might owe you the favor of easier access or anything like that. These provisions are sort of proactive to protect Minnesota's statute and make it more constitutionally solid, prevent it from constitutional challenge in the future.
Mr. Goldsmith, excuse me. For the single committee and the changes from 100 to 750 in 16 and 17, and then up to 1500 and 18, that's just for political committees?
Section 16. Section 16 would be candidate committees, so they go to 750. Okay. Section 17 would be regular political committees. Your PACs that we all know that unions have them, interest groups have them, lots of independent ones exist. Section 18 would be the political committee that only makes independent expenditures, so they're not giving to candidates or party units. They would go to 1500. And 18 also includes those that only make ballot question expenditures. They would go to 5,000.
But that would exclude local ballots and local education questions?
Correct. Chapter 10A does not in any way involve local candidates or committees. That's 211A, and that would stay the way it is. And they don't actually register, but they do have reporting requirements.
And then for 16 and Section 16 and 17, is that just a one-time registration?
Right. You register when you meet the threshold, and that happens once. Moving on to Section 19, this relates to commingling. And what it actually does is creates an exception, or it makes it clear that associations that have political funds, which is just this account that they use for their political spending, they don't have to have a separate checking account. That's pretty clear from case law now. It's also the board policy, but this makes it clear that they can use their same account as their main association account to do their political spending, and that would not constitute commingling. So it's a protection from them. Section 20 adds the ballot question political committees to the same provisions that independent expenditure committees already have. Actually, the definition of independent expenditure committee is broad enough that it includes ballot question committees if you go through the technical part of the definition, but the board recommended that the statute be amended to specifically include ballot question committees. Section 21 is a corollary to the increased threshold for registration. In Minnesota, there's really two provisions about registration. One is the threshold, and one is the filing requirement. So this just raises the filing requirement to the same threshold as the trigger. It wouldn't need to be in two places, but it is in Minnesota statutes. Moving to Section 22, this does the same thing for the other types of committees, because now we have a different threshold for different kinds of committees. We needed a new provision to change the filing requirement for those. The first threshold is to form the committee or fund, and this one is to register it. They're actually both at the same dollar amount. Section 23 and 24 relate to the requirement to obtain names and addresses of all donors over $20, that would increase to $50. So it would reduce the burden to some extent on treasurers who get smaller contributions, especially at fundraising events where cash might be involved. So a contribution of up to $50 would not be considered an anonymous contribution, and you wouldn't have to have the name and address until you get to more than $50. Section 25, you have a 60-day period of time to return any contribution and thus avoid a violation that contribution might have caused. This would increase that period to 90 days. Section 26 relates to when you start filing. Again, it's triggered by the financial thresholds, and so the provisions here simply make changes to increase to track those same financial thresholds. And when we move on to page 12 at line 12.16, this is the reporting schedule. It's modified a little bit because we had two reports, not for candidates but for political committees and funds, that were just 13 days apart in an election year. So we've modified it to spread the reports out more evenly. It doesn't add any reports, except that for constitutional office candidates and state parties and caucuses, it does add three additional reports in an election year, but not for other candidates. Section 28, and that goes on for a couple of pages, for all purposes raises the itemization threshold from $100 to $200. So on your reports, you would only itemize those transactions that exceed $200 instead of $100. Actually, if we look at it, and I will talk about it later unless Representative Winkler wants to take over, when we talk about limits, if you made adjustments from 1993 to the present, there would be a 62% increase. So $100 then would equal $162 now. Again, to protect and strengthen the constitutionality of the statute, the board felt the legislature should at least look at this provision. If the legislature wanted to leave it the same, having looked at it and considered it, that by itself would increase, would strengthen the constitutionality, but the board thought that an increase would be appropriate at the same time. Moving on to section 29, this doesn't change very much. It clarifies some of the provisions. It does change the threshold for the 24-hour notice for candidate committees by reducing the percentage to 50% of the election cycle limit. That's because the limit is going up a lot if this bill is adopted, and so the threshold should drop to keep it sort of where the same threshold is now. It also exempts a couple of groups from these reports that are required now to file 24-hour notice reports. Ballot question committees wouldn't be required to file them because the pre-primary election really isn't particularly relevant, so they wouldn't have to file the pre-primary report. And a person who loses the primary wouldn't have to file 24-hour notices before the general election because they're not going to be on the general election ballot. Section 30 relates to a person who makes expenditures just from their own money, and that increases the reporting threshold the same as it would have been increased for various political entities doing the same type of expenditure. Sections 31 and 32 are parallel. These two sections implement the settlement agreement in the recent case of MCCL versus the Campaign Finance Board, actually versus, I think the caption is Weiner now, Deanna Weiner. The resolution of that case, which challenged many parts of Minnesota's law, was that we can no longer require a political fund to file a statement saying we didn't have any activity if they didn't have any activity. We can't do that. And so this says specifically in Section 32, if a political fund has no activity, they don't have to do anything. And we'll probably give them a call to make sure they just didn't forget about the requirement, but there's nothing proactive that they have to do. And that was required first by temporary injunction and then by settlement of the case. And this was the only part of Minnesota Statute Chapter 10A that was then ultimately affected by that case. Section 33 is one of the sections that you've probably heard about. There is an amendment that will probably be introduced today that would remove this section from the bill, and the board opposes that amendment. I've sent you some information about it. Once the courts recognized that you didn't have to say vote for or vote against to require disclosure, and at that time it was actually prohibition, but that was removed by Citizens United, but the required disclosure of political communication, people started using all sorts of ways, and the current way to avoid disclosure is to send out a mailing or run an advertisement that says, call Representative X and tell him or her, thank you for keeping Minnesota healthy through the budget process, or call Senator Y and tell him or her to stop doing such and such an activity. These types of communications are not express advocacy because they have a purpose other than to influence an election, namely to influence what the representative does in the legislative field. At the federal level, the bicameral campaign reform act was passed. It was called McCain-Feingold, and it defined electioneering communications. And instead of having to influence election, they're limited in other ways. First of all, they only possibly can occur 30 days before a primary and 60 days before a general election. So once every 2 years for the House, once every 4 years for other candidates, this 90-day period or 30 and 60-day period would trigger. And during that period, if you promulgate an advertisement or communication that specifically mentions a clearly identified candidate, you wouldn't have to register with the board if you're not registered already, but you'd have to file a statement about that communication, including who paid for it and who it affected. Now, originally, this law was drafted much more broadly than you see in the first engrossment. One of the first things that happened was the 501c3 nonprofit corporation, the charitable nonprofits in the form of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, came to us and said, under IRS regulations, nonprofits are allowed to do nonpartisan voter guides. And here are the criteria that makes something a nonpartisan voter guide. And we said, we have no intention of covering those kinds of things. They're not electioneering communications because they don't really affect or try to influence one election over another. They're just a guide of everybody. And so we added a significant provision that's in this engrossment that exempts nonpartisan voter guides. And the nonprofit community, as far as I know, is comfortable and happy with that provision. Another thing that happened was another group came to us and said, we do lots of distributions of literature through county fairs, church groups, small meetings all over the state, all over the district. And we said, that's not the type of thing we're trying to capture in this bill. What we're trying to capture is that blanket mailing that people do into the district to the residents' homes. And so another exception was written into this bill for that kind of distribution. So you can distribute literature in any way, in any quantity, at any time that you want, with only one exception. And that is if during that 30 and 60-day period, you actually mail the literature into the district to the resident, to the voter's residence or business, that kind of targeted mailing, that would be covered. And then again, only if you mention a clearly identified candidate and you're mailing into that candidate's district. So we've excluded a lot of literature distribution in the hope that we will have a bill that you can accept that would capture those mailings that are made into the district. And you probably all saw them during the last election cycle. The board thinks that they will only increase and not decrease. And by the way, this particular type of concept.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Say, on that section, when you talk about actual mailings, so do inserts into papers, do those things count as that, as a mailing?
Yeah. Yes, I should clarify, Madam Chair, Representative Howe. Yes, I appreciate the question because I should have clarified that. The statute says mailed or distributed to the voter's residence. So distribution would include a hand-delivered lit drop or distribution through an advertiser like you're talking about.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, so if there's a billboard that said vote for so-and-so by one of the groups that you're talking about, that's neither mailed nor distributed to their residents but could be in their district, could you address that for me, please?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, yes, Representative O'Driscoll. Actually, we wouldn't even reach the electioneering communications provision there because if you say vote for somebody, that's an express advocacy element, and that would be an independent expenditure. So if an organization spent more than $1,500 doing that type of activity, they would be required to register a political fund because they were making independent expenditures. If they ran that same billboard and it said, call Representative O'Driscoll and thank him for his efforts on behalf of the state of Minnesota during those time periods in the district, that would be an electioneering communication. Besides literature, it does include signs, billboards, radio, and TV. The statute totally excludes websites, email, any kind of electronic communication. That's not covered and would not ever constitute electioneering communications.
ever?
Mr.
Goldsmith? Yeah. Ever?
Under
ever?
Unless the Madam Chair, unless the legislature chooses to change the law, not ever. That this is for electioneering communications. Now, websites could still be covered under express advocacy as an independent expenditure if they, you know, run a website that says vote for or elect, but as an electioneering communication, not ever. And Madam Chair and members, as executive director of the board, I don't see that changing in the foreseeable future. It would take some evolution of both court cases and practice in the state before we could evaluate whether the board would ever recommend that, but it's not on our agenda for the foreseeable future.
Please proceed.
Section 34 and 35 and 36 are fairly technical, and they simply simplify the process for terminating a campaign committee or for the board terminating them, and Section 37 also does the same thing. Section 38 is the provision that would change the spending limits for the elections of candidates, and it does two things. Number one, it puts the spending limits on an election cycle basis. So for House members, your spending limit covers the 2 years. That gives you more control over your spending. We have lots of people trying to do spending in the first year of an election cycle, and some do it successfully, some fail. This would give you the ability to manage that spending. And also, the limits are increased to give the candidates a better voice, a larger voice, in their own elections, which we've seen shrinking over the last election cycle. And the corresponding contribution limits increase then will allow the candidates a better opportunity to actually raise that money. It's the board's hope that some of the money that's now going into independent expenditures would go into candidates' committees instead. Section 39 and 40.
Mr. Goldsmith, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, I realize this changes it to a cycle as opposed to per year. I mean, at first blush, it looks like a pretty steep increase to me in both of them. But what is, well, let's just take for state reps, since that's what we all are. What is, I know the election year limit is something like $34,300. What is, I can't remember offhand, what is the limit in the other year? So I'm just wondering how much of an increase it is over the cycle.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair and Representative Freiberg, it's 20% of the limit, so about $7,000. So we're at a little over 40. I will say, Representative and members, that these numbers are still somewhat in play. They're different in the Senate, and they will likely be resolved either in a on the floor or in conference committee. So I urge all of you to communicate with Representative Winkler on the numbers that you think are appropriate for the final bill.
Representative Freiberg.
Well, thank you for the invitation. Maybe I'll just say it here since you mentioned that. I mean, it does seem high to me. I mean, if we're going to have a citizen legislature here, $30,000, I realize, you know, independent expenditures can dwarf these amounts in close races, but, this seems like a lot of money to raise. You know, if your opponent is able to raise that easily, you know, I don't know. It seems high to me, and then it, you know, almost, well, I guess it's not quite doubling it because it's over the cycle, but it's still a fairly substantial increase. And then the contribution limits, looks like they're being tripled. They both seem, I don't know, it seems high to me, but that's my thought.
Mr. Goldsmith, would you explain the cycle? Does that start January 1st of the year that a representative would take office and then go through the election of the following year?
Madam Chair, that's correct for the House, yes. It always starts January 1 after an election year. So senators typically would have a four-year cycle, though once every decade a two-year cycle. After redistricting,
so
the Senate has a two-year cycle.
Senators would have a four-year cycle. not a two-year cycle.
Madam Chair, senators have 2 4-year cycles followed by a 2-year cycle in the year after redistricting.
So senators, okay, all right. Representative Crenshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Goldsmith, and Representative Winkler, perhaps you can answer this too. I'm just curious, as I look at the number, one of the things that comes to mind is probably the cost of advertising versus in the rural versus the metro. I mean, in our area, a couple backyard porches and drop some flyers off and we're good, but there's much more media. Does this reflect some of that change, allowing for those higher costs in other areas?
Madam Chair, Representative Crenshaw, what this really reflects is the fact that the campaign finance system in Minnesota that we've had for some time, in which we've focused on small contributions through the PCR program and the public subsidy program with voluntary limits on expenditures and contributions, and the prohibition on corporate treasury money being spent in campaigns on independent expenditures, all of that has been slowly whittled away by Supreme Court precedent. And the idea behind this is that the more money that floods into politics and flows through third-party independent expenditures, the less control and the less voice the candidate has in the conversation in the election. The lesser ability of the candidate to have a conversation or deliver a message to voters directly rather than having third parties speak on their behalf. And so the reason why these are increasing is to direct more of the campaign money through candidates rather than through independent third-party expenditure groups who may or may not represent the candidate's views very well or run the kind of campaign that the candidate would like to run. And so that's the theory. It isn't about any other change, although I would say these limits have not increased for some time. So it's really to reflect the new world that the Supreme Court has given us through Citizens United.
Representative Kahn.
Well, I think the worth of Minnesota's campaign financing laws has been the number of people who do abide by the limits and who do agree to in both campaigns. And the example that I've looked at is a friend of mine who's a state senator in Iowa, and his first campaign, he was a House member then running for the Senate, and his first campaign, I think, cost over $1 million. Which was just incredible. I mean, after he was elected, then the subsequent ones have dropped to normal. But the thought that you would have to raise that much for, I'm sure, Iowa Senate districts aren't that much different from ours, is just kind of appalling. So that's what happens when you don't have limits in place.
And our population has changed in our districts now, too. It has grown from 33 to 39,500. Proceed.
Members and Madam Chair, just to make you completely aware, the board doesn't advocate for any particular number. The board put out some numbers to get the conversation started. Now that the conversation started, it's completely up to you where the numbers end up, and the board doesn't have any position on those numbers. Having said that, the contribution limits are covered in section 43. As I mentioned, they've not been increased since 1993. Just an inflationary increase would have resulted in a 62% increase, although the board has recommended something higher than that. The only other provision in the bill that is somewhat substantive is section 46. This relates to, I'm sorry, section 48. This relates to how associations report the use of their general treasury money when they use it for political purposes. And under the current statute, it's quite easy, and in fact, the common practice and the usual result, to use a legal method that's provided for in statute that results in no itemization, thus no disclosure of the sources of money that these organizations use. The change in the bill would be to eliminate what we call a pick and choose method. There's already a proration method in the statute and that would be the method people would need to use. So if you spent, if a corporation spends 10% of its money on independent expenditures, it would attribute 10% of each donation to that purpose. We've also, though, raised the itemization threshold so that once you do that in attribution, rather than reporting donors of more than $1,000, you would only have to report donors of more than $5,000. So while there's a slightly more stringent method of attribution, there's a much higher threshold before itemization is required. I think the remaining provisions are basically technical, but I, and of course, Representative Winkler would be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Goldsmith. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm sorry I was out of the room just for a minute, so if this has been discussed, someone can give me the sign and I'll stop. As to the issue of the cycle, Mr. Goldsmith, I just want to make sure that the cycle goes all the way past the election through December 31st, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, that's correct.
Okay. And then, Madam Chair, I made a second question, or really more of a comment, and I do appreciate Representative Freiberg's comment earlier about raising the cost of elections for a citizen legislature. I'm sensitive to that. On the other hand, as the board said, I think, in its analysis when it met in February, these limits haven't been raised in a very long time. And I think we've struck the right balance in Minnesota over the years. I have friends in Virginia, for example, where their state assembly raises the equivalent of our House, pretty much the same population cost routinely, $100,000, $120,000, $150,000. We don't want that. This seems to be at least moving in the right direction. And then in terms of independent expenditures, since those have swamped candidate spending, I mean, we all know, you've looked at colleagues of ours, whether it's 2010, 2012, the dear departed colleagues of ours in either cycle, and you look at the amount of spending by outside groups, it's almost gotten to the point now where if you look at a pie chart of money spent in an election, something we can all name the elections, this cycle and last, the candidate spending is a much smaller piece of the pie than the outside spending. The candidates themselves are almost side players in their own elections. And so this, I think, will help a little bit. And then the other issue, too, is that there's at least some evidence, more than speculation, that if we raise the limits, it might, at the margins, just at the margins, I'm not naive about this, but I don't think I am, at the margins, help trim a little bit some of the outside spending. And I say that because there are donors out there who say, I would love to give to Representative X, but she's already reached the max, so I'm going to give it to Citizens for blah, blah, blah. Or I'd love to give to Senator Y, but I can't, so I'm going to give to this outside group. Again, I'm not naive. We're still going to have oceans of outside spending, and I don't know what to quite do about that. But at the margins, at least, it might have that effect. So that's why I think an increase, a pretty good increase, is probably in order.
Representative Winkler, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the bill before the committee?
Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, I will move that House File 863 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Ways and Means.
All in favor of the Simon motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Yes, Representative Winkler. Motion is before us. Or the bill is before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if the A-10 and the A-8 amendments are in conflict with each other. If one is adopted, whether the page and line changes would disrupt it. So I guess I would leave it to I have the A-10.
Right.
I don't. The A-8 is not my amendment, so I guess we can see what happens.
The way I read it and went through, in most cases, it is not in conflict. Is that right, Representative, or Mr. Gary?
Madam Chair, Mr. Gary.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. So you could do both amendments and it would work fine.
Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, I'll move the A-10 amendment.
Representative Simon moves adoption of the A-10 amendment. Are there any questions? Representative Winkler, do you want to go through that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the A-10 amendment is really just a technical updates that Mr. Goldsmith has suggested. I'm not sure that it's really, there's nothing substantive in it.
On page 7, Representative Winkler, line 21, you want the violation to be a gross misdemeanor? It says it's a gross misdemeanor. Oh, that's not part of the amendment. I'm sorry. But you want that to be gross misdemeanor.
Madam Chair, there is another version of this amendment that I winnowed down that would have made that a misdemeanor instead of a gross misdemeanor. Yep. But that was taken out. So, okay. And Mr. Goldsmith is emphatically answering a question.
Mr. Goldsmith?
Madam Chair, the intention of the board's recommendations was not to change the status of any crime under the existing statutes. And so for Section 14, penalty for false statements, if you look at line 7.15, that is already a gross misdemeanor. And so that language is simply continued. It's just moved to a different location in the same provision. The one that is being changed is on page 8, line 6, where we inadvertently elevated a misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor, and that's the amendment, line 1.22.
But the first one is in law, and you want it to stay in law?
Correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Any other questions on the Winkler Amendment? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The Winkler Amendment is adopted. A-10. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, it's going to be Representative O'Driscoll. I came down with the flu last night, and I would rather just sit back.
Oh, yeah,
Representative O'Driscoll. Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope you're not disappointed that I was the relief pitcher here this morning on this particular amendment. Representative Benson.
I did wonder when you and Representative Simon left the room what was going on, but now I know.
Madam Chair, before I offer the amendment, I just want to make a clarification. We did move the bill and not pass the bill. I just want to make sure, because I kind of getting some people looking around the room and on the committee and stuff saying they thought we passed the bill instead of moved the bill before the committee. So maybe we want to make some kind of belt and suspenders process so that we don't have any technical issues.
For passage?
I'm getting, as I watched, as we voted on that, some in the room and some around the table were kind of thinking that maybe we ended up having the passage of the bill before it being moved before the committee. So I'm just asking from a technical standpoint that we go back and make sure that we have the bill before the committee with the amendments and so we don't have any technical issues.
Being on the prevailing side, should I move to reconsider the decision to re-refer this to the Committee on Ways and Means?
Sure.
Okay.
You
okay.
Have to be on the prevailing side.
Oh, okay. I'll do that. I'll miss. So moved.
Representative Freiberg moves reconsideration of House File 863, first engrossment, be recommended to pass and be referred to Ways and Means. All in favor of reconsideration, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Representative
then we need to
Freiberg.
Vote on then I think we need to vote on this again.
House File 863, first engrossment, is before the committee.
Right. Then we need to vote on this.
Two?
You
just put the amendment.
Representative Simon moves adoption of A-10.
Right.
All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. First engrossment has been amended by A-10. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple things. Number one, with the A-8 amendment, I first of all would like to have a roll call on this.
The A8 amendment, I think, will take what's a good bill and make this able to pass bipartisanly through the legislature, which is something that the governor has suggested we need to have all along. And Representative Simon and Representative Winkler and myself all sat on the Elections Committee, and we've worked very, very diligently to try to put together bills that deal with elections and campaigns and things through that committee that would be bipartisan in nature, so that we could move them through the House and the Senate and get governor's signature on those. In an attempt to try to get the great, I think we may need to step back and do the good. And the A8 amendment simply preserves organizations and groups' rights of free association and the ability to communicate with those members of those associations, whichever they may be, to be able to keep their members informed and, yes, perhaps even influence members' votes on particular candidates. Members and citizens in this country for a long time have had the ability to have free association, and this, in my opinion, would be a curbing of a First Amendment right, which would lead us to a constitutional challenge to this provision, and the state would needlessly have to spend money at this point to defend a law that would no doubt be ruled unconstitutional, or at least litigated, if not found unconstitutional or modified in some way. And so my hope is that we would be able to go ahead with the A8 amendment and delete that language that would limit that free association of people with organizations that may want to influence or inform people about the outcomes of elections and how they may want to vote. My fear is that we will not have bipartisan support if we do not have that. And I've been hearing anecdotally from various groups and both sides of that issue that people aren't happy with it. Some have come more public with that. Some are less public with that. But again, if you think about people having the right to free association within organizations and the ability to collectively get their voice out there, then you think that the A8 amendment is going to be a good thing. And so with that, Madam Chair, again, I request a roll call.
First, you move adoption.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Driscoll would like to
speak of technicalities, right? with that as the setup, then, Madam Speaker, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A8 amendment for adoption.
And you'd like
and I'd also like a roll call on that, please, in case I'm not clear with that.
And Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I oppose the A8 amendment. Just to, by way of a little bit of background, I understand that the MCCL is concerned about this electioneering communications section in particular. And as Mr. Goldsmith noted, although he didn't mention their organization in particular, they were the ones raising concerns about county fairs, et cetera. And so language was included in the bill earlier in the committee process to prohibit or to not require disclosure of who's paying for that type of communication with voters. Subsequently, at the direction of the chair, I met personally and spent some time exchanging language and conversation with leadership of the MCCL and offered to put language in the bill that would exempt all communications with members from the requirement that they disclose who is paying for the communication. And I think the fair statement would be that we have a philosophical disagreement about the nature of campaign finance regulation. That was, and so the offer was made. It wasn't accepted, and we are before us today on a bill that I think does two very simple things. It increases the expenditure and contribution limits for candidates, and it increases the amount of disclosure that third-party independent expenditure groups have to comply with in order to spend money to influence elections. That is exactly the world of campaign finance that the Supreme Court has handed to us. They basically say that we have to have fewer restrictions, but we can have more disclosure. This bill represents more disclosure in the A8 amendment, both on the electioneering communications as well as requirements for disclosing some of the larger donors that these that the independent expenditure funding organizations have. This would significantly undermine the disclosure requirements in the bill. This does nothing to do with the right of free association. at all. And you, Representative O'Driscoll, stated that if we adopt this, maybe there wouldn't be a constitutional challenge. Well, when we passed the law in 2010, almost unanimously, at the legislature signed by Governor Pawlenty, that required corporations to disclose when they spend money in campaigns, that was challenged on constitutional grounds as well. It had nothing to do with electioneering communications. It had nothing to do with the specific mission of the MCCL, but they were the lead plaintiff in challenging the constitutionality of a disclosure law, which was specifically noted as being permissible by the Supreme Court opinion. So I don't think that adopting this amendment clears this of constitutional challenge. I think that is likely under any scenario. I think it significantly undermines the disclosure elements of this bill, and I oppose it and ask the members to vote no.
Any further discussion? Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, I just want to make sure I understand what we're talking about. And you mentioned county fairs, and I heard some other discussion earlier about literature that may go out, and we've all seen it, to call so-and-so and tell them this, which, you know, it sounds like advocacy. But so what does this amendment do that you're opposing? How's that going to change it?
The
bill, as amended, as it's before the committee, requires organizations that spend money on mail and, I guess, newspaper inserts, but, you know, whatever form, if they're directly sending communications to voters or dropping them at their door, if they're spending money to influence the voter's opinion of a candidate or of a elected official, or to try to persuade that elected official to vote a particular way, the bill as it stands today requires them to disclose who's paying for the communications, prepared and paid for by, and then they have to go to the campaign finance board, register, they have to list donors, etc. That's what the bill is today. This amendment would take out the requirement that communication that they're sending out would have to disclose the donors. So it doesn't prohibit the communication. It merely eliminates the requirement that they have to say who's paying for it. And the specific type of communication we're talking about are those things that say, call Representative Purcell and thank him for being a great advocate for for Bemidji and our businesses here, you know, something like that. Or it could say something else. But that's the kind of communication we're talking about narrowly in this amendment, on as it relates to your question.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I was fortunate enough to have the Chamber of Commerce or somebody say something like that about me up my way, that then they would have to put on there paid for by the Bemidji Chamber of Commerce, whatever.
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, that's correct.
I'm struggling with why anybody wouldn't want to say who they are, I guess. So, okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, they have to do that, and they have to file with the campaign finance board the people who are funding their advocacy work.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I guess I would like, if there's any groups here that would like to speak for or against the A8 amendment, I would like to hear from them, because I think this is important that we really understand the real intent of this amendment.
Ms. Rao is asked to testify. Ms. Rao.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to testify today. My name is Andrea Rao, and I am here representing MCCL, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. We are a grassroots organization with chapters and individuals throughout the state as members of our organization. And MCCL, as has been made aware to the committee today, is opposed to this electioneering communications provision because of the chilling effect that it would have on our free speech. Now, with a membership ranging from, say, about 70,000 individuals to up to maybe around 500,000 individuals, depending on how one defines a member, MCCL is Minnesota's oldest and largest pro-life organization. And individuals donate to MCCL really for two reasons. One is because they like what we do and they want us to keep doing it. And two is because they want us to keep them informed of current pro-life issues, things that are going on in Minnesota and around the country, and the events that are surrounding those. Now, it was suggested that this is very narrowly tailored language, that this would only apply to cases where people are intentionally trying to influence elections without using the trigger words and those kinds of things. In fact, MCCL is we are truly an issue advocacy organization. Now, without a doubt, we definitely have a political side to us. We have a PAC. We actually have two PACs, a state PAC and a federal PAC, and we abide by all of the rules and regulations and willingly that go along with that. However, there is a side to the organization as well that is truly about just providing information on pro-life issues. And I know during election season, I am involved with our PACs. I do our reporting, and I do a lot of work with candidates and various things too, and you get wrapped up and you seem to one often seems to think that everything has to do with elections, but that's not always the case. There are other things going on in the world as well, and it just a example of something that could potentially go on that MCCL may want to talk with our members about, and something that we don't believe would be or should be considered an electioneering communication. And generally no one would think of it as an electioneering communication except for the fact that it happens close to an election. Right now, I'll use this example just because it's a current event that's happening right now, but it could happen close to an election and then would trigger these kinds of things. Many of you may be familiar with a very high-profile case that's happening in Pennsylvania right now. There was an abortionist who is on trial, and the trial has been going on for weeks, and he is charged with murdering four live-born infants as well as one mother. And this is, an issue that is very important to individuals who are pro-life, an example of things that we see happening. And we hope that those kinds of things never happen in Minnesota. But if that were to happen in Minnesota, that is certainly something that we think that the people of Minnesota should know about. It's definitely something that our members who pay us, who give us money to keep them informed on pro-life issues, would want to know about. And if that were to happen 30 days before a primary or 60 days before a general election, and we sent out a letter only to our members and stated that this was happening and that, in fact, in the last year, Representative John Ward had introduced legislation to regulate clinics and require inspections of them to make sure that this kind of thing couldn't happen in Minnesota, and we would urge that the legislature to pass that legislation in the future. A communication like that, a letter sent to our members to inform them of something currently going on, but also providing background on the issue, would then be electioneering communication under this law. And we think that that is wrong. We think that we have a right to speak about issues, and would appreciate the opportunity to continue doing so without regulation. We don't believe that communications to our members or even our potential members in the future should be regulated as campaign speech. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my question is for Mr. Goldsmith. Does this bill change how groups can communicate with their members? My understanding under current law, and I come from a union perspective, so I'm thinking about our union can communicate with our members because they're our members, but if we communicate with the general public, it triggers a whole different thing. So does this change the way that works in law, or because of what I'm hearing her object to is the fact that she's not able to communicate with her members. So, Mr. Goldsmith, does this change the way that law treats that, or does that stay the same?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, it doesn't change the way you can communicate. As Representative Winkler made clear, and the courts have made abundantly clear, we can't limit or restrict the ability to communicate in any way, but it would potentially have an effect, and that is the disclosure effect. First of all, the communication, though, would need to be mailed to members in the district of the person who's mentioned. If you circulate it to any members anywhere else, it doesn't count because it's not targeted to members in that particular person's district. The communication would have to mention, clearly identify a specific candidate. So if you say, you know, call your legislator or call your representative in general, that wouldn't be electioneering communications because it wouldn't mention a clearly identified candidate. And then there are quantity and price dollar thresholds that you would have to spend. So if you didn't meet those thresholds, it wouldn't be an electioneering communication. But if all of those requirements were met, it potentially would be an electioneering communication. And then you'd have to put on it who paid for it, who prepared it and paid for it. And if you met those thresholds, you would file with the Campaign Finance Board a statement saying, we did this, here's what we spent, and here's how we paid for it. Now, the thresholds in the bill about telling us how we paid for it have been increased quite a bit. So for organizations with small donors, no donor ever will be disclosed who donated $5,000 or less, and because of the proration, it's going to be quite a bit more than that. But there could potentially be a disclosure requirement. I might add one other thing, that we can't anticipate every single possible communication that should be excluded from this bill. And so the bill does say that the board can recognize additional exclusions through the advisory opinion process or rulemaking. That's the same as we have for non-campaign disbursements. So if a person had something that clearly seemed not to have the potential to influence an election, the board could exclude that. But the purpose of the bill is to bring in those things that are mailed to the voters or distributed by billboard or television or radio to the voters in the district that have the potential to influence the vote. And if the communication did that, it could be subject to disclosure, yes.
Representative Nelson.
So, Mr. Goldsmith, so a communication about information, per the example that was given about the case that's happening in Pennsylvania, but sending it to the members in that district or across the state would not trigger because it's not saying do support or don't support or contact. If it's just saying this is what's happening, that would not be included. That would not be included under electioneering. It would not have to be reported.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, in the example that was given by Ms. Rao, she indicated that the letter would say, Legislator X introduced a bill in the last session that would regulate this particular type of conduct. So there would be the name of a specifically identified candidate included. If it were mailed to that candidate's district, then it would be electioneering communications subject to reporting if it met all the other thresholds.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to add, and that has to be 60 days within the 60 days before the election in order to count. So the scenario would be there's an issue ongoing, and you think it's important to send out a mailer to people in a district in September or October of an election year that specifically mentions that candidate's name and specifically mentions a particular issue, and that it wasn't done for the purposes of influencing the election. But in such a scenario, they still would only need to disclose people who, at a minimum, gave $5,000 to pay for that mailing.
Representative Nelson.
So, Madam Chair and Mr. Goldsmith, so if it does not include a candidate's name, but is purely informational about an issue, it would not have to be disclosed, or it would not have to have their name, their disclosure on it.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, absolutely correct.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for Representative Winkler or the testifier, but everybody's treated equal here under the bill. I mean, this we aren't singling out any entity. Everybody's treated the same.
Madam Chair, Representative Purcell, that's absolutely correct.
Thank you.
Representative
Detmer. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I know a lot of times we're talking about a 60-day prior to the elections, Representative Winkler, and you know, a lot of times our state fairs, our county fairs, and our, you know, a lot of these things are happening, you know, during that time frame, and a lot of times there's groups that are at that are at the fairs that are handing out information about issues and so forth that might really restrict some of these different organizations in doing that.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, and that kind of communication at a state fair to a general audience is not included in the disclosure requirement. So we have taken into account that concern in the bill that, already. It would only cover if you are mailing to somebody or directly trying to communicate with voters at their home.
Madam Chair.
Representative Detmer.
What would be the difference between a snail mail and a email? Same words, same communications.
Madam Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Representative Detmer, the email is not covered. Sending out an email is essentially free. The cost of doing the mailing is what triggers the disclosure requirement. Yeah.
Mr. Knapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Winkler. My name is John Knapp. I'm an attorney at the Winthrop & Weinstein Law Firm in Minneapolis, and I'm representing today the Coalition of Minnesota Businesses. The Coalition of Minnesota Businesses is a lobbying organization registered with the Campaign Finance Board as a lobbyist principal. First of all, I'd like to say that there are many things in the bill that we do support. The modernization and updating that's contained in the bill. We support, I think, the spending limits and contribution limit increases that Representative Winkler and Representative Simon spoke to make a lot of sense for the reasons that they articulated. And I'd also like to say that the Campaign Finance Board has been very open with us from the beginning, even prior to the start of the legislative session, and in sharing the language that is in this bill. However, there are two issues in the bill that are addressed by Representative O'Driscoll's amendment that we haven't been able to come to an understanding with the board regarding. And the first is Section 5, the definition of express advocacy. And it's at the bottom of page 2, and the first clause of the definition of express advocacy is: express advocacy means a communication that clearly identifies a candidate and uses words or phrases of express advocacy. Those words or phrases of express advocacy would be things like vote for, vote against, elect, defeat. And this, in effect, is existing Minnesota law. This is the standard that the Campaign Finance Board currently applies in determining whether or not political speech is the type of advocacy that should be regulated under our campaign finance laws. The additional language, though, that's added at the top of page 3 is, in effect, a new standard in Minnesota law. And that standard is a communication, when taken as a whole and with limited reference to external events, such as the proximity to the election, is susceptible of no interpretation by a reasonable person other than as advocating the election or defeat of one or more clearly identified candidates. So this adds to our objective definition of express advocacy, this very subjective definition of express advocacy. We know if we use words like vote for, vote against, that's going to be express advocacy. But we add this new clause that lets the Campaign Finance Board determine whether or not specific speech is express advocacy. And from a corporate point of view, the concern relates not only to how Chapter 10A is administered, but also to Minnesota Statutes 211B.15, which prohibits any corporate expenditure to promote the election or defeat of a candidate. And part of our concern is that with this enlarged definition, we're creating a very subjective standard for whether or not a communication promotes the election or defeat of a candidate. And the concern is that it's going to deter speech that would otherwise occur. Section 211B.15 is a criminal statute. If a corporation or a corporate official expends money to promote election or defeat of a candidate, they have committed a crime that's punishable by up to 5 years in jail. And the corporation is subject to being dissolved under Minnesota law. That corporation can no longer exist. So we think that the standard that is added here is, although as Mr. Goldsmith explained, it may be allowed by Supreme Court precedent, it's certainly not required, and we think it's a route that constrains political speech that this legislature should not go down. I'd also just like to, a word to, on the electionary communications point that Ms. Rao talked about. The concern there is really a philosophical concern. I mean, it's certainly, we don't contest that the legislature, if it wants to require registration and reporting of any expenditure that identifies a candidate before an election, if you want to do that, you certainly can do that. We just question whether or not that's a wise decision in the overall context of free political speech and free political debate. What you're saying now, if you pass this electioneering communication provision, is any communication that mentions a candidate 60 days before an election and spends money to do that, and the person that does that is not registered with the campaign finance board, they're now going to have to file a registration statement giving information regarding that that expenditure. 60 days is a long time. 30 days before a primary, we think, is a long time. Maybe some period before a general election or a primary is reasonable. We think 60 days and 30 days is too long a period of time. So thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Winkler.
Mr. Knapp, is the Coalition of Minnesota Businesses registered with the Campaign Finance Board?
The Coalition of Minnesota Businesses is registered as a lobbyist principal. The Coalition of Minnesota Businesses Political Action Committee is a separate organization, but that organization is also registered with the Campaign Finance Board as a political committee.
And is this a lot of businesses?
It is. It's actually the Coalition of Minnesota Businesses is a coalition of trade associations. So it would be, for example, the Minnesota Retailers, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, the Minnesota Realtors Association, a number of different business-oriented trade associations.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I was wondering if maybe Representative Winkler and Mr. Goldsmith could answer a couple questions for me.
That's why I'm here, Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, I appreciate that. But Mr. Goldsmith was joining you, so I was just giving him the courtesy of coming to the table. Explain to me how, if a group that promotes sunshiny days, and that's what they're advocating for, and there are two candidates that are running, one who likes stormy days over sunshiny days, could that group that likes sunshiny days send out a communication that says, candidate X likes sunshiny days, candidate B likes stormy days, and just have that out as an information piece? And would that be considered influencing the election, or is that an education piece about the positions that candidates have?
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll,
Winkler.
Mr. Goldsmith can walk you through the details of how this is done, but we do have an exemption for nonpartisan voter guides and things of that nature built into this, so that we are not, so that we are not prohibiting the League of Women Voters from putting out a field guide to candidates or the Star Tribune or whoever else would do this.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then again, back to the idea of emails. You had suggested, Representative Winkler, that there is no cost to the email. Well, there's a cost to having the system in which you're generating that email on, and some subscriber fees perhaps to be on a network to be able to distribute those. So those would be costs, would they not, that you would end up having? It's just the picking and choosing. Mailing seems to be, or inserts in the newspaper seems to meet a higher threshold than the devices that might be used to communicate in a modern society using technology.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, the comment about emails being free is my comment. I think the board's position is that they don't. There's no legal precedent for including them and requiring that disclosure, so they decided to not do it. My point would be that most organizations, the marginal cost of sending out a blast email is essentially zero. Most of them have the systems in place anyway to do all sorts of things. So it's in my mind substantively different than having to go out and buy stamps, print letters, and do all the other types of things that actually cost real money every single time you want to do it.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Representative Winker, I think it's still real money when you have to buy the hardware and the other kinds of things that you would need to disseminate that. And in a society where printed materials are less frequent, I don't know if your bill is going to, and my amendment would say it's dealer's choice, if you will, on how they want to communicate, but you're excluding on electronic communication, where any organization this day and age, whether it's a business or whether it's a consumer group or whoever, asks for both a physical address and an electronic address in which to get a hold of people. So any group that wanted to continue to do emails would be able to do that, and would be able to put candidates' positions, names, and be involved in electioneering communication. But yet you're just going to limit it if they choose to or want to use a different method of marketing their message, that they would be confined because they chose to use a printed form versus an electronic form. Am I understanding that correctly?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I think you have the facts correct. I'm not sure that your characterization of those facts reflects an accurate understanding of it, but you know, I think all the more reason why the A8 amendment is not needed, because there are plenty of other forms of communication that are not regulated, because they are, it really costs no marginal money to send out an email once you've already had the sunk cost in there. You know, it's just we have a little different point of view, but I think it makes the A8 amendment less necessary, because your point is there are plenty of electronic alternatives. I agree, and they're really don't cost much, so the groups that oppose this seems to me could just use those if this is their major concern.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Winkler, anybody who's involved in business and marketing and trying to reach a broad audience knows you need to have multiple ways of doing that, and some of that's electronic and some of that's printed. That's why we still have newspapers. You can subscribe to a newspaper online. It's the individual's preference and choice. Why would we then not keep that option and choice open? You say that the facts are correct. You've suggested that to me, but you're saying that your interpretation is different. So we have a difference of opinion on what you've said the facts are. And so that's why I think that we don't want to go down this road and create extra work at this time for Mr. Goldsmith and the members at the Campaign Finance Board, and creating additional legal challenges at this point. This is a good bill without that language in it, Representative Winkler, and I think we're going to get great bipartisan support. I think you will see people on both sides of the aisle peel off on this, and we will probably not get an elections bill or this. And so the hour and a half that this committee is invested, I think we're trying to shoot for the great when we could have the good. And I encourage members to vote yes on the amendment. Otherwise, I do fear that we will not have any reforms in this area at all. Again, as I stated earlier, anecdotally, I am hearing from groups on both sides of issues saying some are more public and some are less public than others, saying this is not something that we're interested in. And if you believe that organizations should have the right to communicate with the different devices, be it print media, be it electronic media, or whatever, then you vote for the A8 amendment. If you think that only certain kinds of technologies that might be targeted to certain groups who are more tech savvy and they can have direct electioneering with those folks, then vote no on the A8 amendment. But remember, we represent all of the people in the state of Minnesota, and not everyone in the state of Minnesota is as tech savvy as the persons that are sitting, you know, next to you on your left or your right.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just going down that line of questioning, if cost is a measure, then if we use electronic communication, such as advertising on Facebook or Google or some of these others, and you reach that threshold, now do we fall into that realm?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, it's important to distinguish express advocacy or independent expenditures from electioneering communication, first of all. Express advocacy is covered by whatever medium is used. It could be a website, it could be email, and so on, because that either says vote for, vote against, or can't be subject to any interpretation other than as advocacy. With respect to electioneering communications, electronic media is excluded. The board didn't reach this position in a vacuum. First of all, in an early version of the bill, actually electronic communications were included, and it was based on the input from the same groups that opposed the remaining disclosure that we removed electronic communication, because those groups say we use email often, we use websites. We decided to exclude that from the bill because there isn't legal guidance in the form of judicial opinions to explain how we ought to be evaluating website hits or email communications. The board isn't ready to make a recommendation to the legislature on that subject. If it would be at some point in the future, I don't know. And secondly, the type of communications that we are covering are those communications where the communicator can essentially force the communication into the home of a person in the district, and they know that person is in the district. That really is mail and physical distribution of a piece. You can get email out through some bulk drop of spam, but you wouldn't necessarily know who it's going to or how many people in the district, and the implementation of the other thresholds would be problematic. So at this point, the board felt it was appropriate to exclude the newer forms of communication until everybody has a lot more experience in that area. Madam Chair?
Mr. Goldsmith?
If I just might make one more comment with regard to electioneering communications. If a group that engages in this doesn't already have a political committee or fund registered with the board, it doesn't have to register. It only has to file a statement. There's no registration requirement. If you already have a committee or fund, you can report through that fund just like you regularly do. But if you don't have one, you just send us a statement.
Madam Chair.
Representative Odris.
And I know that we need to get this wrapped up because we have session starting at 10 o'clock. But what I've heard today is that billboards are just fine for advocacy because it's not going to your home. It's still telling people that group's position. Electronic communications are exempt when you could send it hard mail or you could send it soft mail through the email. It's still trying to influence the outcome. Why is it that because of the cost, we're saying that printed media and printed mediums are going to be treated separately or differently in this? That just does not, maybe we have to step back and look at that. That's all I'm saying is let's get this right. Instead of trying to shoot for the great, let's go for the good and try to figure this out in the interim so that early next year the legislature could look at something that we have a better comfort level with. Because, again, I fear that we will not, if this amendment does not go on and the language stays in there, I do not believe that you're going to have a bipartisanly supported bill that the governor is going to sign. And that is, again, from what I'm gathering from both sides of the political aisle.
Representative Heidegger.
Oh, I was just going to make one final comment. And I think that you folks know from working with me that I'm a very much a public policy person. And that's where I'm speaking firmly from on this, that we want to have good public policy. And I don't know if we're there yet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a very quick comment. This is a huge bill. I mean, there's a lot of changes on this. And Mr. Goldsmith's gone through a lot of meat here, and it is a bipartisan bill. If we can bring this amendment on it, I think you'll get a unanimous vote if we can do that. And I think people really need to realize that. Members need to realize that all this work can become a bill if we tack on this amendment. That's all I want to say.
Madam Chair, I can wait for a wrap-up. I thought maybe we were done. But
take your last shot.
Madam Chair, members, I don't believe is a sound public policy reason to oppose the bill in its current form. If people are sending out communications in order to name a candidate and talk about an issue, it isn't so unreasonable that they would have to disclose anybody who gave at least $5,000 to pay for that type of communication. It applies to all groups evenly, and the statement about cost was my statement. It was not the Campaign Finance Board statement. Their statement was it's not practical at this time for them to regulate the cost of electronic advocacy in this form because there is no legal guidance on how to do it. It may be ripe to do it in the future, but for now, requiring more disclosure is a good thing. It applies evenly to everybody, and I think it is fully ready to go. As for the partisan nature of the vote, that is certainly up to you. I think requiring disclosure of who's paying for politics is not a partisan issue.
Roll call on A8.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Newton?
No.
Representative Detmer?
Yes.
Representative Benson?
Yes.
Representative Bernardi?
No.
Representative Dean?
No.
Representative Freiberg?
No.
Representative Howe?
Yes.
Representative Kahn?
No.
Representative Krasha?
Yes.
Representative Leidiger?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Representative Purcell?
No.
Representative Swatsky?
Yes.
Representative Murphy?
Yes.
Eight to eight.
The amendment does not prevail.
Representative Wills.
Yes.
Amendment prevails.
Representative Newton.
I know we've already taken a vote on this, and but in essence, there are three forms of media, and we've not talked about broadcast media, which, like email, can also penetrate a certain area. And say you have a former mayor who goes on radio or TV and advocates for one individual or another, you still have the same sort of situation that you have with email. So I think, you know, we have to deal with the things that, and I know the vote has already been taken. Print media seems to be the easiest to deal with right now, but if you're going to look at it, you also have to look at broadcast media as well.
Representative Winkler?
Madam Chair, I think the committee has spoken, and I would still urge a yes vote on the bill and recognize that there's still time for the issue in the bill to evolve, and I hope with the amendment there will be a unanimous yes vote out of the committee.
Representative Simon?
Madam Chair, I will renew the motion that House File 863, actually I'll change, new motion.
Please.
I'll renew the motion that House File 863, first from Grossman, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Rules.
Any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. The motion prevails. Thank you very much. Representative Newton?
I'd like to move the minutes of April 10th, 2013.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. This meeting is adjourned.